Hello, everybody. Just before we get to the Red Boys episode up ahead, we do have a draw to do. We've been handing out Dauber codes to folks who have written us a review, but we did save one code to award very transparently and quickly on the show. First off, we want to kindly thank all of you who've taken the time to write a 5-star review and maybe some kind words along with that, which helps grow our show even just a little bit and gives us some added visibility ahead of the fantasy hockey season. But for now, I'm going to randomize the list of those still in the draw, and the winner is Oskimo. Oskimo, we will get in touch on how to claim your Dauber Hockey Prize. Thank you all again for taking the time and generously and kindly writing us a review. If you still want to, there's a warm, fuzzy feeling in it for you, and we encourage you to do that. But for now, thank you all. Thanks for listening, and on with the show.
Karlsson, Karlsson, världens bästa Karlsson. Karlsson, Karlsson, hoj, här kommer Karlsson. Karlsson, Karlsson, ingen, faktiskt ingen annan Karlsson spelar jag så bra som mig.
Karlsson, Karlsson, Karlsson scores!
Karlsson, Karlsson, världens bästa
Karlsson. Yes, welcome everybody!
Another episode of the Keeping Karlsson Fantasy Hockey Podcast, the longest running fantasy hockey podcast in the world, hosted by two guys, one of whom I think it's fair that I can call myself the red boy of fantasy. Last season, everything was going so well. Then that Shea Theodore injury at the Four Nations. Then I traded for Kaprizov for some nutty reason, thinking he was going to come back for the fantasy playoffs. Red boy, Ilan Dubrovsky, right here, but with me to break down all of the actual NHL player red boys of the 2024-25 season, players who started hot and then fell off a cliff. It is the Fantasy Hockey Robot, the Poobah Prognostication, the IPP MVP, himself, Brian Kalm. And we have an IPP column in the spreadsheet for the IPP MVP. How's it going, Brian?
Hey, wow. What a, like, Michael Buffer coming out in this intro. Thank you. Hi, everyone. It's really nice to be... I'm a little thrown, but I'm really excited. You know, I wondered, Ilan, as we were getting ready for the show tonight, whether we present more as green boys or red boys.
Do we have a season? Like, you're saying, like, basically we start September, I guess, right? That's when our shows really ramp up.
I'm even talking, like, just in a single episode.
Oh I see. Oh, definitely red boys. I think we get a lot of,
so
by the end
strong.
Yeah, we start
then
strong,
and then the end.
Yeah, then it's like messages on the side, like, I really need to go. Then, like, interruptions about, like, have to go help a baby. Though that usually happens closer to the start of the episode, to be fair. I find when I'm editing, it's usually pretty clean for the first hour or so, and then all of a sudden the edit points really skyrocket. I think also that's around the time when, maybe, you know, when I prep the show outline, probably around halfway through the show is when your prep is over and you're winging it for the second half. You could correct me if I'm wrong about that one, Brian.
Yeah, I could see that. But I think I prep what's a reasonable amount, actually, and then you just stretch the show longer.
I see. Okay. Yeah. Well, so we'll have to figure out whose fault is it that we're red boys?
Or are we really red boys? I think in the season, our download numbers are definitely has green boy, red boy energy. We start real strong. And then, well, everyone starts real strong. It's less about us and more about the natural circadian rhythms of fantasy hockey.
Okay, well, let's right now this podcast is neither. Right now this podcast is just like, I don't know,
A2
Lusterinen. We're just like a guy that kind of is just nothing the whole way through. So let's get going here. So yeah, what we're talking about is, we just recorded a show last week. Check it out if you haven't heard it, where we talked about the green boys, which are the players who started not so strong and then ended really strong. So my spreadsheet with my conditional formatting colors them green for their big percent increase in performance from the first half to the second half. Today we're doing the opposite. The dates we're using, first half is October 4th to January 5th. So we're going 3 months. We're cutting off the last week and a half of the season when a lot of weird stuff happens. And I've got some numbers here. We basically end up with a percentage and a total diff of, like, yeah, like how many points they had in the first half and the second half. And then Brian's going to dive into, I guess the main point is, we're going to try to figure out who's the real version of these player. Is it the start? Is it the end? Is it somewhere in the middle? What to predict for next year? I'm not going to start with the biggest red boy. of the season.
Oh, okay.
Because last episode I started with the biggest green boy was Marco Casper. Then I was listening back and I was like, that's not such a hot start. So how about that? I'm going to do the biggest name red boy I could find on the list. That's a tease. I know, Brian, though, before I get into it, I think there was one other thing you wanted to talk about as a prelude before we got into things.
Yeah, there's a few things. First, I think we're presented by Darber Hockey. I mean, I know we are. I'm just, you might have said it already and I missed it, but I don't think you did. So there it is. Okay. Just so it's there contractually.
Somebody digs at me.
It's not a dig. It's just, okay. You know what?
I forgot about the Darber Hockey.
Well, no, when I say it, I have a 50-50 chance. Like, I'm confident you didn't say it, but I'm also know that there's sometimes where I say you didn't say things. And you're like, I just said it. Why aren't you listening? Which already happened off mic once this episode. So a couple notes before we get started. The advantage in these episodes, in case you're wondering, like the Green Boy episode, like your advantage there is in draft ranking, right? Because we're identifying players who played really well at the end of the season. And if that second half was for real, then they're going to be ranked. Like if your draft rankings are based on last year's performance, you're going to find them lower than they ought to be. So that's the Green Boy advantage. Now, the Red Boy advantage in the episode coming up is in recency bias, right? Like some of these players, our most recent memories of them are being terrible and letting us down and being dropped to free agency and no one wanted them. And if their second half that was poor was not for real, that was the aberration versus their solid first half, then you're going to find value in these Red Boys too. Also, shout out to our friend and former Short Shifts host, Ben Burnett. I think we do need to shout Ben out for coining the Red and Green Boys phrase at least once a year.
Okay.
I also want to mention one note unrelated to Red and Green Boys. Puckpedia, great site, fantastic site. You know what they're really great at? Responding. John Bruno, one of our Kickupful coordinators, I mentioned on the show last week that some of the ages in player depth charts were not showing correctly. And John did a little digging, found a couple more examples, sent it over to Puckpedia and said, hey, like, just so you know, I think there might be something wrong with parts of your website. They responded like at 11:38 at night, like 1 hour after John wrote them, and said, ah, good catch. Here's what happened, and we fixed it. Thanks a lot. And that's just amazing. So shout out to Puckpedia, who, you know, it's hard when you're one of these sites and like you need, like, reliability is like top notch. Like it has to be, right? If you find any inaccuracy in like any of the sites, or if I do in any of the sites I use, it throws doubt over everything else. So Puckpedia, like I was concerned before and now I'm not. So way to go. Thanks for fixing things, Puckpedia. What else
you got?
I think the only other thing I'll say to start the episode is what I said at the end of last episode. And I said, I should have said it at the start. So I'm going to say it at the start this time. You know, one thing that will be a theme is, like, we're taking two, like, the season is an 82-game sample, right? And the bigger the sample, the more reliable it is. And what we're basically doing is we're cutting it in half and saying, okay, well, in this smaller sample, this happened. In this smaller sample, this happened. And in small samples, you're likely to get stranger results. And the true result is generally what you get from the bigger sample. So when we say the full season is probably a safe representation, All that's coming to do is like prove, or essentially, it's not lazy. It's not like, oh yeah, I'm going to hedge my bets. It's basically saying, yes, an 82 game sample is more powerful than a 41 game sample. But I think there will be a few players on this Red Boys episode whose 41 game samples were quite misleading towards the end of the season. So Elon, I'm ready to get to them. I'm only nervous about you starting with the biggest name because I prepped in order, like, of the reddest boy, and I did stop about, like, after I got through enough players that I thought we'd be able to fit within 2 hours. So now I'm like, I'm terrified. Actually, the biggest names were the least red. So okay. So bring it on. The start might be a little wonky.
I think you'll be fine.
We're going to pull it off. All right, who we got?
I want to start with Brady Tkachuk from your Ottawa Senators. I didn't even realize. I guess sometimes, you know, when you don't have a guy in any of your fantasy leagues, you sort of, you know, he's good, you know, he's whatever, you get the general vibes, but you don't really follow the day-to-day so closely, and he's not the kind of guy we talked about on the podcast often. You're not going to be, like, adding or dropping Brady Tkachuk. But, so he started the season. He was fantastic. He had 37 points in 38 games. It's like an 80-point pace. But, yeah, in the second half, Brady Tkachuk, only 18 points in 33 games. That is not good. That we're looking at a 45-point pace there. I'd imagine he was still rosterable. You know, you're not going to drop him because he's got all the shots and the hits. You were always assuming that he was going to improve. But that's like a 35-point difference in his pace from the first half and the second half. What the heck happened? And the thing is, like, we talked about some other players on Ottawa last episode. Like, Jake Sanderson was a green boy. Like, usually these guys come in clumps, but it's like Ottawa as a whole was doing fine in the second half. They pushed, they got into the playoffs. Where was Brady? What was he doing?
Yeah, so I think what happened in Ottawa with Brady Tkachuk, and I'll do a clump because we do have a bit of a red boy clump here in Ottawa. We've got Brady Tkachuk, Drake Batherson, and to a lesser extent, Tim Stützle, who all didn't match their first half output. And a big part of the story for Brady Tkachuk and Drake Batherson was that they both lost substantial power play production in the second half of the season, even though the Ottawa power play seemed like was pretty much matching its first half output in the second half. Brady and Drake got in on less. They both had 9 power play points total. Brady lost 5 power play points in the second half versus the first. Drake lost 9 power play points in the second half versus the first. So I think that was a part of it. They both also saw identical drops of about 15% in their points participation rates, which I think describes some of that Ottawa power play continuing to click without them getting in on as many points as they were before. The other thing that happened with Brady, his on-ice shooting percentage was high to start the season. So that dipped a little bit. And again, so usually, by the way, I'm separating 5-on-5 and power play. I'm trying something tonight where it's all situations. So I think the drop in on-ice shooting percentage probably wasn't on the power play. I think that was more at 5-on-5. But the IPP drop was on the power play for Brady Tkachuk. But Brady's on-ice shooting percentage over the second half of the season was 9% versus the 13% that he had in the first half of the season. I would say 9% is the likely more sustainable number, but I would also say Brady's IPP at the start of the season was more likely to be sustainable. It was closer to 70% than the 53% he had over the second half. And I mentioned he lost that power play production too. So all in all, I think Tkachuk's first half is closer to what we can expect going ahead to this next season. He had an 80-point pace in the first half and a 45-point pace in the second half. So this isn't rocket science. He came out, Tkachuk, with a 64-point full season pace. And I'd take the over on that going into next season. And for Drake Batherson, similar numbers, except he, almost identical numbers for Batherson in terms of point paces and everything. 65-point pace full season for Batherson last year. And once again, I will say that the first half was closer to being the real deal than the second half was for both Batherson and Tkachuk. So I would hope that their second halves make my fantasy competition pretty worried, because I would be very happy to snap them up a little later than I would have had to had their second halves been as good as their first.
Yeah, someone like Brady, he was going in the first round of a couple drafts last year. He was coming off a 74-point season. The season before that, he had 83 points. So it was like a huge dip. He ended up with a 62, 64-point pace, like you said, depending on where you end the season. But at the end of the day, he had 4 shots a game on average. Like, it's so good. So yeah. I still could see if I have like 14th pick and I have like, you know, 14, 15, it's going to be hard for me not to just take Brady Tkachuk for those awesome peripherals. And I'm heartened to hear, well, if I do get him, I'll be happy to listen back and hear that you think that almost point per game pace from the first half of the season was the more realistic sample that we expect him to be able to keep it up. Why not? Right? Come on. You're only a 20. He's only 25. Should I say he's only 25, or is it like, oh, wow, he's already 25? I remember when he was a rookie. I guess he's already been around, what, like 7 years? Jeez, Time flies, Brad. We're getting old. But okay, that's Brady Tkachuk. The next big name I want to throw at you, we talked about him a lot, but I don't know if we've actually landed on, like, let the dust settle on Mikko Rantanen. So it's like, the thing with him is this one isn't that tricky. I don't think you need to go too deep into the numbers in terms of, like, why he did better in the first half than the second half. Like, he was on Colorado in the first half, where he's comfortable, where he's succeeded for a very long time. And he, of course, did his thing. He did his Mikko Rantanen thing. He had 57 points in 40 games to start the year. Was looking like he was going to be, like, maybe fighting for the Art Ross. Like, he was, you know, pacing for 117 at that point. And then he got traded to Carolina. Then he got traded to Dallas. Only a 60-point pace in that second half. 27 points in 37 games right at the end there. Of course, then we have the fact that in the playoffs, he had like a couple really good games. It was like two hat tricks in a row, or then there was like a third game. Like there was a clump of games where he like won one series and had a great game to start the next series. So we do actually have like a good taste in our mouth overall for Mikko Rantanen. But just to remind you, for the regular season in Dallas, like even if you forget about the Carolina was the worst. 6 points in 13 games. We don't have to worry about that because he's not there anymore. He's on Dallas. Dallas, 18 points in 20 games. So that's fine, but it's not, you know, 100-plus point pace like you would expect from a guy like Mikko Rantanen. Seemed like it clicked for a bit in the playoffs. Eventually, he slowed down against Edmonton, but we have to remember, like everyone did, because Stuart Skinner became a like God mode for a few games there in that conference finals. It's just I still feel like unsure where to draft Mikko Rantanen. Like, I think he's a star, figuratively and literally, and I think that he is going, like, my gut feeling is he's going to be really good, and like maybe it just took some time to adjust. And I always think back to Joe Pavelski, same team, took him a bit of time, took him like a whole season of being bad on Dallas before he got back to being incredible. So I think that now with time, it's going to be fine, and he's going to be back to being like a 90-100 point guy. But I'm curious to know if you have any concerns with even just this like 20-point sample at the end of the year. Sorry, 20-game sample with only 18 points.
I think there's a lot to not know about Mikko Rantanen, or there's a lot we want to know, but that remains unknown about Rantanen in Dallas. It doesn't help that we saw both Jekyll and Hyde of Rantanen in the playoffs, And it also doesn't help that through the second half of the season, we saw Rantanen play on two different teams, both of which were the second and third teams he's ever played for after like a fairly lengthy NHL career to date, which anytime you switch teams, there's an adjustment period, there's different things going on. So honestly, Elon, I don't know that there's a whole lot we have to read into here. I mean, I can tell you what it's already pretty obvious, which is that, you know, especially as a member of the Carolina Hurricanes, Mikko Rantanen, he played less. He played 2 minutes less per night, which means he shot less, too. He lost a half a shot per game, down from his usual 3 shots per game. So those are the two, like those two outcomes are pretty tied to one another. Less time, less shots, less power play production. He had 12 fewer power play points in the second half compared to the first. One thing that Rantanen definitely didn't deserve was a drop in, well, I don't know, it's less out of his control, but he did, he had a high shooting on ice shooting percentage in the first half of the season. It dropped, it regressed in the second half of the season. So I actually shouldn't say he didn't deserve it, because he probably essentially did. So for Rantanen, basically what we're seeing is we're seeing like a loss of ice time, a loss of like primo deployment, a loss of playing on an elite power play. Like, as good as Carolina's may be, they don't have Cale Makar and Nathan MacKinnon, nor does Dallas, right? Like, you look around, it's a good team, but there's no MacKinnon or Makar on that roster. So I'm going to hope that Rantanen can find his way in the Dallas system to be as productive as he once was, but I doubt the Dallas power play will offer him the opportunity or the likelihood to have as many points as he had in Colorado. So that's something to keep in mind. Also in the back half, well, the one thing Rantanen, going back to deserve, really didn't deserve, like, he's like a 16% shooter, roughly, which is really good. In the first half of the season, he shot over that by about 5%. The second half of the season, Rantanen undershot it by about 5%. So you balance those out pretty reasonably over 82 games, and you have essentially the same goal numbers that Rantanen put up in the sample we're looking at, which let me just pull that up real quick. It was a 31 goals in 77 games. Remember, because we're leaving out the last little bit of the season for Rantanen. So I think that's reasonable to still expect in Dallas. Like I still think that Rantanen can deliver first round value in Dallas. It's just a matter of how ready you are to take on the risk that he doesn't. Maybe for like the first week or two or month or season as a Dallas star. So at the draft table, you're going to have to make that call. And unfortunately, all this to say, the second half for Rantanen really just looks like a guy who was adjusting and faced some regression at the same time. I'm not at all writing him off because of that second half. But it really would be nice if he already had like a full half season with Dallas under his belt when we saw everything go right.
Yeah, of course. That would make it easier. All right. Let's go to our next red boy here. I'm just going to mention a couple defensemen that are very like the worst of the worst red boys. We don't have to dive into them, but just I have to say it because it really stood out. It's like, yes, I remember this so well. Brock Faber was actually pretty fine to start the year. He had like a half point per game, 20 points in 40 games to start, which is like, I think people who drafted him were maybe hoping for a little better, but maybe that was reasonable. And then he totally fell off a cliff, just disappeared. Only a 14 point pace in the second half. And then another defenseman, maybe kind of similar in terms of big ice time, Travis Sanheim on Philly was crushing it to start, also like a bit above half point per game with a bunch of good peripherals, and then also disappeared, only 16 point pace in the second half. So I'm going to just assume, Brian, correct me if I'm wrong, you believe more in the second half for those guys. Maybe they'll get like 20, 25 points and not like 15, but you're not expecting Brock Faber or Travis Sanheim to be draftable in anything but the deepest of leagues?
Yeah, I think I'd be happy to leave Brock Faber on the shelf, but let me actually dig in for a minute because Faber is on a Minnesota team that has a few guys featuring on the red boy list. You've got Brock Faber, Marco Rossi, and Matt Zuccarello all ended up having some noticeable decline in the second half. And of like in this sample, like, well, look at this. All Minnesota Wild players in the time frame that we're measuring in the second half of the season played exactly three games with Kirill Kaprizov. And I think that's a pretty good explanation why,
for example,
yeah, their on-ice shooting percentage dropped pretty substantially for them all. Because name another Minnesota Wild who's great at converting. You've got Matt Boldy, and that's the end of the list. Rossi and Zuccarello had also their own like unlikely shooting success early on, like in the first half. Rossi shot over 20%. Zuccarello shot almost 20%. And there's other variants there too for Rossi and Zuccarello and their points participation rates. So I think Kaprizov coming back is going to help. I think it's almost unfair to like really get down on Rossi and Zuccarello, although they both have question marks hanging over them, right? Like Zuccarello wasn't even like playing on a top line when Kaprizov was out. And if I recall correctly, when Kaprizov came back, I don't think it was like an automatic reunion for Zuccarello.
For what it's worth, their last game they played, which was in the playoffs, they were rolling Eriksson Ek, Boldy, and Kaprizov on one line. Then, Zuccarello with Marcus Foligno and Ryan Hartman. And top power play had Zuccarello. And I don't think he's going to come right away, but just as a reminder, there is a new name coming into the picture next season in Danila Yurov, who I don't know if he's going to be third line, but I could see him being second line center. I don't know. So like maybe power play at some point. So just another, and by the way, another new name that's coming in is Ziv Buyum, who might challenge Brock Faber for power play. So a lot of unknowns. That's going to be a really fun training camp to start seeing where the lines shake out to start.
Yeah, exactly. So when we're thinking of Rossi and Zuccarello for next year, we've got to think, okay, is there anyone aside from Kaprizov that they can play with and succeed, because they both spent time out of favor. And Rossi, of course, has been or was the subject of trade rumors, especially in the dogger days of summer. And then Brock Faber, if you like him because he's a power play quarterback. I mean, as I said last season, I still don't like him even as a power play quarterback, but there's even less reason now with Buyum coming on. So, I think the smart thing to do for Faber is to expect nothing from him and then like be pleasantly surprised if he delivers wherever you might have drafted like Brant Clark last season, like pre-Doughty injury. Maybe that's where you can draft Faber just to see what happens. But generally, I think you could leave him be, even though like the minutes are huge for Faber. He starves the score sheet, and he's very good at
it. It's almost impressive how few points he gets with how many minutes he plays. Like, I feel like you,
it's like
you
he's trying to yeah. be invisible. He's like, I'm going to show up. I'm going to play 30 minutes, and no one's even going to know it.
Maybe he's noticeable on the defensive side, but definitely not on the score sheet. That's for sure. Here's a blast from the past. Remember Alex Laferriere, and we were calling him Laugh 2, and you were saying he was like the Western Conference Paterka, and like, remember that good old days?
Of course
days?
I do. Like it was a it was one of my better calls in a long time to give him some love before the season. That one paid off, although more than it should have. Do you want to keep introducing, or do you want me to jump right in?
Well, let me give you the numbers just to remind people. This is not even like the red boy, green boy goes like from like one half to the next half. But really with Laferriere, it was mostly like the first 20 or so games. He had 17 points in 23 games. It was such an incredible start. You may be like, yeah, he was getting top power play. He was only 3 power play points in that first quarter. So it was a lot of it was just happening at even strength on a line with Byfield and Warren Fogle. I don't know. It was incredible. Everyone was excited that they drafted him or that they, you know, picked him up out of free agency. But yeah, by the end of the season, he totally disappeared. Alex Laferriere, only a 25 point pace, 10 points in his final 33 games in the sample I'm looking at. So not rosterable at all. Everyone dropped him. My memory of like the end of the year is I have no interest in this guy. And I don't think now looking at these numbers, I'm going to have renewed interest. So I'll definitely need you to convince me that there's any reason at all to think about Alex Laferriere as anything more than just a guy who went on a hot streak for a couple months.
Huh. Okay. I actually came to a bit of a different conclusion. I mean, Laferriere was scoring on 15% of his shots in the first half. And like, we weren't sure what he was capable of, but it seemed like a lot. It seemed like more production than we expected. We were also very frustrated because Laferriere was playing on the top power play, but getting no power play points. And really, it just felt like we were squeezing like all possible production dry with every goal that came after like the first couple weeks. And like, we saw. The signs were not that this would be sustainable. But what I don't know if Laferriere could shoot 15% through a full season, but I'm even more sure that Laferriere won't shoot 3.4% over a full season, which is what he did in the second half of last season. Laferriere, that's a 12% swing. And like at the lowest, like at a baseline level, I'd expect Laferriere to be a roughly 10% shooter. So it's a swing and then some. That's basically defenseman level shooting percentage and conversion.
Yeah, but if I may.
You may.
We're talking like a 25-point pay. So even if you're like, oh, he deserved to score a few more goals. So fine, give him 35. Give him 40
points. Okay,
he's still not
you.
Someone I care about.
I got
about.
More for you.
You're going to need to give me a lot to make up for that terrible pace.
First half. Laferriere participated on 62% of the goals scored while he was on the ice, which is like, yeah, that's like, that's even a little below what we'd expect, like an average top six forward. Mm-hmm. And in the second half, Laferriere was in on 40% of the goals scored while he was on the ice, which is high-end defenseman numbers or very unlucky forward numbers, especially in the top six playing with Kevin Fiala. So I would expect that to regress too. So you're right, the goals went away. But so did those assists, too, getting in on the action. And I don't think that he deserved to lose them all. Also, while he was on the ice, he saw a 4% drop in shooting percentage. And I think some of that might have been his own, like his own shooting misfortune over the back half. But I think his teammates were scoring a little less often, too. I think over the second half of the season, one thing I noticed is that Laferriere added a half a shot per game to his numbers, and he spent three quarters of the season with Kevin Fiala. So I think, here's what I think about Laferriere. I think the first half version of Laferriere can return, but like not specifically that first quarter where it seemed like everything he touched turned to gold. So like keep the first half, which was like some good and some not so good, and he ended up with like a mid-50s point pace. I think he can get back there. I think he's more likely to be that player than a 25-35 point player as he'd be in the second half, even with only regressing his shooting percentage.
Okay, so deep enough league, maybe a couple, last couple of rounds if you want a safer pick. You're saying maybe a 55, 60-point guy ceiling. I could take it.
Yeah, I don't think you have to draft him. Like, I think you could let him go. I mean, if he's warming up with Fiala, like, that's interesting to me. Yeah. And Byfield, too, right? Who we were talking about, you know, with Kopitar. Has he announced this is the last season? I can't remember.
Well, they just said he's not going to be signing, like, an extension. So the plan is that this is, like, the last season as of now. Yeah.
Right. Okay. But, like, I assume we'll see how things shake out for, you know, as what the transition plan looks like. But Laferrere spent a lot of time with Byfield and Fiala, but not Kempe. Speaking of Kopitar, by the way, Kopitar
he's
and Kempe.
Guy on this list.
Yeah. Do you want to share some quick numbers and then I'll share some quick thoughts?
Well, yeah. Kopitar is especially noteworthy. He had such a big start. He had 39 points in his first 38 games, was doing incredibly, and then, fell off the map himself. 23 points in the next 38 games. It's only a 50-point pace. I'm sure no one was dropping Kopitar, but I'm sure everyone was like, oh, I kind of wish I could just drop Kopitar. It was really disappointing. And this is a guy who, as we've just been discussing, is no spring chicken here. He's going into an age, 38 season? Yeah, he's going to be turning 38 next month. I think that there's a good reason to expect that he'll continue to sunset, especially now that they've announced that Kopitar isn't even going to be like extending his contract and this might be the last season. Feels like a good sort of pass the torch kind of moment, which, you know, makes me wonder if maybe that second half will be more representative. Maybe he's not centering the top line all season. Maybe he's not like always featured on the top power play. I don't know. Like, I'm just saying that would be a concern, but he, even with those, you know, positions and deployment, he still was struggling at the end. So yeah, I'd be nervous. Like, I'm not going to like leave him undrafted, but I definitely would not be using like one of my picks where I could be getting someone that I'm like confident in and taking Anze Kopitar at this point.
Yeah, I think I'm with you. Like, maybe I'll take Kopitar late because he's not that far off from having been like a good player, right? Like,
sure.
I think he had a 68 point pace or something 2 seasons ago. Am I right?
Well,
he's
a red boy.
This past season, 68 point pace. Like, he's been a 70 point pace player. So, yeah, I know you're worried about the second half, but on the whole, okay. Here's where I met with Kopitar. And I think I said this on the show last season. He stopped shooting. Like, his shooting days seem over. He had 97 shots last season, and he played all but one game. So 1.2 shots per game for Kopitar, which is a further decline on last season's career low, 1.6 shots per game. So over the last 2 seasons, Kopitar's lost a full shot per game, and I'm not sure they're coming back, especially as Kempe establishes himself as a big, like, as a quality shooter. The thing that really fed Kopitar through the start of the season was he was shooting 25%. So he was not shooting a lot, but when he shot, he scored a lot. And Kempe, playing with Kopitar, was shooting 18%, which is both higher than what we'd expect them to do. So as Kopitar's own shooting percentage regressed and Kempe's shooting percentage regressed too, back to where we could reasonably expect them to be, we saw what happened in the second half, which was pretty bad. I don't think Kopitar's full season next year is going to look that bad, but I'm not so optimistic. It's hard to write off a guy when we've just seen him put up another 70-point season. Like, Kopitar has been between a 68 and 73-point pace for 6 consecutive seasons, which is pretty, like, amazing. His power play production is super consistent, so I'm not sure that he's going to be taken off the power play since he shows no sign of slowing down there, and he contributes to a solid power play there in Los Angeles. I think this could be the year that Kopitar is more like a 60-point pace guy, just based on, again, he stopped shooting. He's given that shot to Kempe, who increased his shots, at least over the second half. Kempe shot more. He had another half a shot per game, but his shooting percentage went down. So I think Kopitar and Kempe started off way too hot, and then they both regressed, and that impacted themselves and one another. So that's what happened in the second half. The 50-point pace for Kopitar over the second half seems low. So I don't expect that to be. And Kempe, like, just relative. He had a 58-point pace over the second half. And that doesn't seem right for Kempe either, does it? So maybe, you know, add 10 points to each of those paces, and you've got what you can expect for next season. Kempe, I'll say I expect more, like, potentially more from. Like, I think he's more likely to break 70 than Kopitar is to break 60.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you there. Like I said, I just have this vibe that it's like a torch passing kind of. I'm also just so interested to see what's going to happen with Byfield next season. I feel like this has got to be the year. And I know we thought this going into last season, so we got that wrong. He only had a 54-point season at the end of the day. But I feel like Byfield could really just be in such a prime position to explode if they just give him the Kopitar deployment. You know, give him Kempe, give him the power play, and just let's see what Byfield can do. I don't know if that's going to happen, but I'm watching, like, I don't know. If you're drafting after preseason has started and you're getting a sense of, like, deployment, if you're seeing that Byfield is getting a prime position, hopefully he's really trained. I want to see a good workout video from Byfield, actually. I got to say, like, that's really, I feel like, what I need right now. I want to know that this guy knows that there's a big opportunity coming up, and it's time. This is the season. He can't come, if he comes in not, like, in incredible shape, you know, that'll be a missed opportunity. So I'm very, he's a guy I'm into, but I guess he's not really a green boy or a red boy. He was actually a little bit of a green boy. Byfield had a 58-point pace in the second half compared to 43 in the first half. So it already started, but I want more than that. I want more than the 58-point pace, but definitely agree with you with Kempe. Kempe's already, like, guaranteed. I think he's going to lead that team in points. Not even going to be close. Let's take a break. We come back, Brian, I'll give you a hint so you'll be able to be prepared here. I want to go to Columbus and talk about the newly signed Dmitry Voronkov, who just signed a 2-year deal. And I guess he was definitely weighing his first half more than his second half to get a 2-year contract of 4.1 mil. So we'll talk about Voronkov in just a sec. All right, Brian. So yeah, like I said, I want to talk about Dmitry Voronkov, who was another one of these kind of like laugh two, right? Like a found money kind of guy. You got him late in the draft. You got him in free agency. He actually had a really good workout video. I don't know if it was last year or the year before, but I remember he was like, when I'm talking about a good workout video, I'm not talking about that Ovechkin one where he's like, you know, stretching. Like, I'm talking like Voronkov was like lifting like 5 plates doing a squat. It was something crazy like that. I don't remember exactly. But anyhow, Voronkov was starting like incredibly. He was on the top line. He had a 26 points in 31 games to start off. That's a 69-point pace. Then I guess there was the Monahan injury. Some stuff happened. Next thing you know, second half, only a 39-point pace, 17 points in the next 36 games. So a real drop-off, not someone that was worth holding in fantasy. Going into next year, it's really just, we already had talked about Fantilli in the last episode where he like exploded in the second half after the Monahan injury. And now it's just like, how are we going to predict this deployment? Who's getting the top power play, for example? Is there space for Voronkov? Like, you've got Kent Johnson in the picture also, who I expect to take another step. So I don't know. I'm going to tell you my, but again, you've got the numbers. I'm just doing gut feel. I feel like Voronkov's just like a really good, like, middle six, complimentary sort of guy that's not going to reach the heights that he had at the start of next year. And maybe this like $4 million contract kind of speaks to that. That's not like star money. So I don't know. I'm going to be banking on like a 55 to 60 point season from Voronkov. Probably not someone I would draft, but I'm very curious to know if you're going to tell me otherwise.
So wait, you're not going to draft like a 55, 60 point player? I think that's very draftable.
You think? This, I don't know. I don't think there's a ceiling. So it's kind of like once we're getting to that end of the draft, I guess it depends how my roster is looking. Maybe, hopefully I'm not in a situation where I'm like, oh man, I could really use like a 55 point guy. You know, it's like, I'd rather, we're talking like 15th, 16th round, maybe take a swing. I don't know. I feel like with Voronkov, the thing is we did see a ceiling. I just wonder if it's still there. So you tell me, Brian.
Okay.
I'll take a 55, 60 point guy if I think there is like the possibility of 70. You know, just even like a 10% chance or 20% chance.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. I think he's basically what his full season averaged out to cut to the chase here for Voronkov. Like, he had 11 goals in the first half and 6 goals in the second half. He shot 23% in the first half, 6% in the second half. And I think his true shooting percentage is probably somewhere in the middle. We haven't seen enough of him to know. But I would expect, like, he picked up 22 goals last season. I could see him repeating that. And maybe it's just a little more consistently distributed through the season versus Feast in the first half and Famine in the second. By the way, Voronkov, 8 power play goals last year. So if you're in a deep enough league and there is like some kind of bonus for power play goals, keep that in mind.
If he gets top power play, I guess that's the thing we have to wait and see.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he had nearly 60% share of the power play time through the season. Elon, who do you have on the Columbus power play going into next year?
Let's see.
I'm pulling up the depth chart now.
Off the top of my head.
Yeah, okay.
And then you have the depth chart, so you can let me know if I'm missing anyone. But Werenski's going to be there. I have a hunch. But okay, aside from him, Monahan, I would assume, Marchenko, Kent Johnson. And then, yeah, there is room for one more. But then I feel like Fantilli, I would have ahead of Voronkov.
Jenner, Voronkov.
Oh, you love Jenner. Yeah, of course.
And you then actually like, love Jenner.
Chinnikov asked for a trade. I love Jenner.
Won't be him. Are you for real?
I loved Jenner like 5 years ago when you hated Jenner.
You still love Jenner. I never hated Jenner.
You definitely did. We'll go back and find those episodes.
I
think he's the odd man out, but... Well, I would just say
Voronkov on the top power play. Yes.
I don't think it's likely.
No, it's not a lock. It's not a lock. And there were enough in like Jenner and Jenner.
Forget Jenner.
Well, no, he just missed. He missed Jenner and Monahan, two guys who could be on that top unit.
Well, Monahan definitely
missed substantial time. So it's hard to know. So that's one piece for Voronkov. Well, if he loses that top power play deployment, although he had 11 power play points on the season, which. Like, we could expect something close to that from the second unit, for what it's worth. The other thing that hurt Voronkov in the second half last season, which was, like, pretty predictable, was, like, his line was shooting 15% with him on the ice. And this is in all situations. That regressed down to just below 10%. We talked about Monahan. Like, he had great shooting, and he was playing with Voronkov and Marchenko. And then Monahan got injured, and the percentages that line was putting up, they were still a good line. But the percentages just didn't stay sky high as they were. One maybe telling thing about Voronkov was the last 5 games of the season, he played with Cole Sillinger and Mathieu Olivier, which puts him more in that middle six territory that you were talking about, Elon, versus top six. So I think that's a reasonable likelihood. And let me just quickly, while we're in Columbus, I'll mention Zach Werenski, because you did, on the power play. That Columbus power play struggled down the stretch. Werenski saw 18 power play points in the first half of the season, just 5 power play points in the second half. And I think that was a team problem. I think the Blue Jackets were just running out of steam. They scored just 9 power play goals over the last 35 games. Compare that to 24 in their first 40 games of the season. So that is where Columbus lost power play production and Zach Werenski lost power play points.
Interesting. Yeah. I know a lot of people are talking about drafting Werenski super high next year. Like in some of these mock drafts, he's been going as like the second defenseman, you know, after Cale Makar, over a Dahlin or over a Quinn Hughes. So
Bouchard.
What's your take right now on Werenski? Do you think he's going to repeat this season he just had? I guess I can give the numbers here.
Yeah.
He ended up like basically point per game, which is obviously really great for a defenseman, 82 points in 81 games. I'm giving you the full season totals, 3.7 shots per game. So obviously super valuable and couple, 25 power play points. So yeah. And blocks, like 131 blocks is pretty good for such an offensive defenseman. It was really an incredible, and he was healthy the whole time also, which was the first time he's done that in a really long time. Though we did have some discussion on the Discord about how all those injuries he's had over the years have all been like to different parts of the body. So it like maybe wasn't so predictive of like future injuries and maybe just like bad luck. But maybe you could say like recklessness. I'd have to go see the plays. I don't want to put that out there. Maybe it was like not his fault for every single one. But anyway, to me, it would be a bit risky. I'll take Zach Werenski, like, you know, late second round. I'm happy. But I don't know if I would use such a high pick on someone that's had his first full healthy season and first time being anywhere close to a point per game. Just feels like a recipe to be a little bit disappointed.
Yeah, so there's two clear routes that Werenski took to being near point per game. The first is a career-high 23 goals. It actually, like, he might have cracked that earlier. He had 20 goals in 63 games in the COVID-shortened season. And that season, he was shooting 11%. This season, he was actually shooting, like, a somewhat sustainable 8% over the season. So I actually think Werenski's goal scoring, like, he could be a 15 to 20 goal scorer from the blue line.
But he has to shoot 3.7 shots per game, which is
if he keeps taking 3.5 or 4 shots per game, then he'll keep having those opportunities, right?
To get to 20 goals. Like, I know that we generally, I feel like, correct me if I'm wrong, Brian, I feel like with these analyses, sorry to interrupt, I just wanted to get your thoughts on the shots. Like, you're usually, like, you're looking at the shooting percentage, you're like, that's sustainable, that's unsustainable. But I feel like you're rarely referencing, like, the actual shot pace and, like, if that's sustainable or not. I guess, I feel like we've talked about this a few times over the years. Like, we never really, like, he was never, more than, like, 2.9 to 3.2 shots per game. Then all of a sudden last season it skyrocketed. Like, isn't that something that you'd be a little concerned about? Like, why is it, like, maybe he won't be able to keep that up? Like,
yeah,
he didn't do that the rest first, of his career.
For the first time in his career, like, he topped his previous career high shot rate by 0.5 shot per game. So anytime a player does something for the first time in their career, especially if it's like their, what was this, Werenski's 8th season, 9th season, something like that, you're going to want to, like, think, okay, maybe this isn't going to sustain. But Elon, even if he, like, gives up another 0.5 shot per game and goes back to, like, his previous high water mark of just over 3 shots a night, that still puts him in, like, 15-20 goal territory.
Yeah.
So if
that's how I think I'm going to draft him. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's still pretty close to a point per game pace. It's not at a point per game pace, but it brings him, like, up above 70. The other thing that went right for him, and it went the rightest it's ever been in his career, actually, it's the second highest power play points total of... it is the highest power play points total of Werenski's career. The second highest was his rookie season back in 16-17. He had 21 power play points in 78 games. This year, 25 power play points in 81 games. And compare that to just 12 power play points in 70 games two seasons ago when the Columbus power play was really, really struggling. So I don't think it's fully out of the realm of possibility that the Columbus power play finds a way to play closer to their first half than their second half as a team. And if they do that, because Werenski's 5-on-5 production stayed pretty close to where it had been in the past. Again, a couple more goals, thanks to some more shots, and huge power play production that we haven't seen since his rookie season. So we've seen it before. That's the nice thing. The question is, can he keep it up? So that's what we'll be looking to see going into next season. I will say that looking at his power play numbers from the last, like, while he's never produced quite at this rate, nothing really leaps off the page at me about, like, this being unsustainable power play production from Zach Werenski. So is he a point per game defenseman? Like, am I drafting him as a point per game defenseman? No. But, and this probably isn't a great comparison, but remember last season we were drafting, like, Noah Dobson as, like, a 70 point defenseman. Mm-hmm. That's where I'd be drafting Zach Werenski. I'd put him in the same category that we had Noah, because Noah Dobson played sustainably well, and we thought it would continue, and it didn't. But things changed around him. I don't think as much is changing around Werenski, so I'm hoping not to make that same mistake again. 70-point defenseman, but the upside for point per game still there.
Definitely. But if you're saying you're going to draft him where you were drafting Dobson last year, it means you're not getting Zach Werenski, because someone else will definitely
go before
him higher.
Dobson went in the third round of my, like, top 50 in my Cupful draft last season.
Yeah. So in some of these mock drafts, I'm seeing Werenski in, like, late round one, early round two. So.
Yeah. No, I won't be getting him.
But it is very exciting.
Name the guy. Like, again, there's at least 5 or 6 defensemen that I would take above Zach Werenski.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of fantasy points per game last year, he's, like, number 2, so it makes sense.
Yeah. I think, yeah, but I think he's jumped Adam Fox, for example, as someone, you know, some of this depends on when other D get drafted. I think Werenski versus Yosi is an interesting thought for next season.
By the way, we didn't bring Adam Fox up, but since you mentioned him, he overall had, like, a pretty decent season, like 68 point pace, but obviously a big disappointment for people who were excited about him from his, like, year before when he won the Norris. But last year he started slow, but his second half was a 74 point pace. So if Adam Fox keeps that up, we didn't bring him up in the Green Boys episode, that could be like a, you know, if everyone's reaching for all these other D and Adam Fox falls now to, like, third, fourth round and you haven't picked a D yet. The Rangers as a whole were weird. Like, Columbus and the Rangers were, like, opposites. Like, Shams is asking here in the chat, do you think Columbus is going to do better in the standings next year? Honestly, don't know. Feel like they could be a regression team as a whole. Like, going into the year, I had no faith in them. I thought this team looked like You know, like they weren't going to be good at all. And they ended up almost making the playoffs. And I feel like the Rangers, we thought were a sure thing to make the playoffs. And then they ended up falling apart, especially in the second half of the season. And I was like, what the hell happened? So I do wonder, like, if maybe next year things could sort of even out a little bit. Columbus will be a little worse. Maybe Rangers will be a little better. And maybe Werenski and Adam Fox will end up around the same fantasy value. Though, of course, I love that Werenski shoots so much more. That's the tempting thing. But I guess let's go back to our scheduled programming, Brian. And let's talk about another defenseman, actually. Let's talk about Vince Dunn, who was definitely a pretty crazy Red Boy. And this is another one I kind of didn't recall. He was so, like, blah in the second half. But yeah, Vince Dunn started off really strong. 18 points in his first 20 games was looking like a steal, because I think a lot of people were fading him in drafts because Seattle had just signed Brandon Montour, so it wasn't a sure thing if Dunn was going to be holding the top power play. By the end of the season, like, his overall power play was 56%. So I guess you would call that top power play, though I recall Seattle was really just going like 1A, 1B, it felt like, for a lot of the time. But yeah, it was going well to start for Vince Dunn, like I'm saying. But then, yeah, that's only 20 games. So there must have been an injury there. Then the second half in 37 games, only 19 points, which is a much more pedestrian 42-point pace. Overall, Vince Dunn ends the season with 39 points in 62 games. Yeah, there was an injury, 52-point pace, which was his worst season in Seattle. Or I guess actually his first season was his worst. But the previous two seasons, Vince Dunn had been around a 65-point defenseman. So was it, were we right to be concerned that Montour coming in was just taking away Dunn's opportunity to have a high-end ceiling? And look, my feeling right now is, yeah, I see Vince Dunn as like a 50 to 55 point defenseman. But I think I've always been kind of down on Vince Dunn, and I was actually like, felt like I was wrong after a couple seasons where he was better.
Yeah, even when Vince Dunn has been doing well and it seems sustainable, like, I think both our spidey senses have tingled about him. It's just like, we haven't always had a good reason to put Dunn down, but we've done it anyway to some extent. I will say, like Elon, you said 50 to 55 points for Dunn. I would go even a little lower. Like, Dunn was in the 40s in the second half. And to me, that looks like the realer version of Vince Dunn. Hmm. Comparing Dunn's first half to his second, he was shooting 20% through his first 20 games. Dunn had 8 goals on 42 shots. I don't know if that jogs anyone's memory of how exciting the start of the season was for Vince Dunn, and anyone who passed on him that, oh, I could have had 8 goals in the first 20 games. Obviously, that wasn't going to last. That I think Dunn got injured at some point, right? I made a note here that this was exacerbated by a small sample. Like, that's all he played in the first half of the season. So Dunn was shooting 20% through the first half, scoring almost every other game. And then the second half, regressed to normal, shot 3.5%. So that's normal. Also, yeah, Dunn's IP.
I'll apologize to everyone for not having this info from the start. We should remember this, Brian. Yeah, he only played 4 games and then missed like a month and a half.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. He also, his IPP dropped, and I think part of that was a function of his own shots not going in anymore. So I think we saw but his IPP regressed to a 35%, which, like, maybe a touch low, but is still like pretty reasonable, and definitely much more reasonable than like the 56% it was in the first 20 games of Vince Dunn's season. So, weird numbers in the first half for Dunn. Weirder because he only played 20 games. And I think the second half Vince Dunn is a lot closer. The one who shoots 3.5% and gets in on 35% of his team's goals while he's on the ice. I think that is more likely the case going into next season. So Elon, 55 points to me seems optimistic. Okay. I'll stick closer to 50, but he's surprised us before and maybe he will again.
Yeah, he's clearly talented. Just it's the team that I don't like, and then the situation, and then he still also seems to never have that like really sustainable ceiling. So yeah, let's do one more really exciting defenseman while we're talking about D here. Here's another guy who was kind of in the Adam Fox category at this point. 3 seasons ago, Josh Morrissey really broke out, had 76 points in 78 games, was a real like, oh wow. He had so many seasons sub 40 points, and then out of nowhere in 22-23 76 points in 78 games for Josh Morrissey. The following season, not as good, but still pretty darn good. 69 points in 81 games. And then last season was starting really well. It was looking like maybe Morrissey was going to go back to that breakout season. He had 37 points in his first 41. It's a 74-point pace. Things were going great. Winnipeg was on fire, as we know. And then the second half, yeah, Morrissey really fell off, down to only 19 points in the next 35 games. That's a 45-point pace. In the end, that left Morrissey overall on the season with 62 points, which is now like is, you know, two seasons in a row of going down. Again, the pace is going from 80 to 70, now to 64. I feel like I said, like with Adam Fox, like Fox is going to be falling in drafts this year, and so is Morrissey. I would definitely take Werenski over Morrissey, but I wonder if there's going to be some value here if people are now seeing him as only a 60 to 65 point defenseman, or maybe you're going to tell us that actually that's the upside because what we saw in the second half was much, much worse.
Yeah, this is an opportunity, I think, for anyone who thinks Morrissey was more like his second half than his first, or will be more like his second half than his first. Although I don't know how many people, Elon, really believe that. But this is actually not so different from the Columbus situation with Werenski, where the power play in Columbus just faltered over the second half, and Morrissey felt bad in Winnipeg. He had just 6 power play points over the back end of the season. That's really unfortunate for him because he had 16 power play points in the first half. And I don't know if you remember, but that Winnipeg power play was going off. They were scoring on a third of their chances through the first 4 months of the season. 39 goals on 124 opportunities. They still scored on a quarter of their opportunities in the second half, but they had fewer, and that only amounted to 22 goals. So the Jets lost 17 power play goals in the second half of the season, and Josh Morrissey himself lost 10 power play points. And I think those numbers sort of line up. Now, I guess part of the question is the Winnipeg power play going to be more like the first or second half next season? I think the second half is probably more likely. But with that said, I still think Josh Morrissey can put together like a solid 70-point campaign, even like just by being on a power play that converts a quarter of the time and gets a reasonable number of opportunities. Last season, Morrissey also saw his points participation dropped over the second half of the season. It might have regressed closer to where it should be, if I'm being honest. But I don't know, Elon. Morrissey is someone who I'm having a hard time giving up on, even if I'm like, yeah, maybe I could see more of second half Morrissey creep in than I would like to admit. I still think that he's much better. Much, much better than a 45-point defenseman. That's not a hot take. I think it's reasonable, even on an average team, to expect their power play quarterback defenseman, who's good, to have at least 10 power play points in half a season, and probably 12 or 13 if you're Josh Morrissey. So that's where I'm at. So I will take him. Like you mentioned, it averaged out to a 64-point pace for Josh Morrissey last season. Maybe that is around where he finishes, and maybe the 70 and 80 point pace days are behind us. It's so weird though. There's he's had 4 consecutive seasons now where he's been in a different 10 point bucket. 38 point season in 21-22, or I'm going paces. 80 point pace in 22-23, 70 point pace in 23-24, 64 point pace in 24-25. And that's one of the reasons that I'm still talking, because I'm just trying to make sense of all of that and come up with a number that makes the most sense. Elon, I'm going to stick in the 70-point region is where I'm going to land for Morrissey.
Yeah, I think I'm going to take the under there. I'm a little bit more concerned. I'm not so far under, but I think maybe what he did last year overall, 65 sounds. I don't know how big of a impact Ehlers leaving is going to have. It can't be great. So I don't know. Winnipeg just seemed so much better than they actually were. They were just winning all these games. So hard for me to believe that Winnipeg is really this powerhouse team. Same with Kyle Connor had this insane season that I'll be surprised if he's able to replicate.
I think everyone really went off on that power play at the start of the season. But I think for Josh Morrissey specifically, and maybe some of the others, they should have cooled off, but not quite as much as they did.
Yeah. So 65-ish. I don't know. Maybe I won't draft him. Or maybe he'll fall to me, and it'll feel like really good value. But I'll be happy to be surprised. Canadian team, I want Winnipeg to do well again. Why not? Okay, let's go back to forwards. Let's do a superstar here. Let's do Braden Point before our next break. Okay, Brian Point, for people who don't remember, he was incredible to start the season. In his first 33 games, 45 points, 112-point pace. Braden Point was looking like the steal of fantasy for the year. You know, he was like taking probably third round. I remember distinctly going to the dentist expecting to get Connor Bedard in the third round of my Kupfel draft, getting sniped, and then taking Barkov. I'm trying to remember now if like Point was another option at that point. But if he was, then I really blew it, because, or at least it felt like it for a while, because he was just, you know, playing like a top five fantasy guy. But yeah, in the second half, Braden Point really tailed off, which I guess is why I'm saying about everybody. So I'm probably a broken record on this episode here. 67-point pace in the second half, 31 points in 38 games. And it's not like Point was getting worse line mates. Like, he's always up there with your Kucherovs, and he played with Gensel, and yeah, generally those two, I guess. Maybe once in a while they switched around, but generally, yeah, that's pretty sweet. And Kucherov never slowed down, right? Or did he? I don't want to get this wrong. Didn't Kucherov win the Art Ross? I don't know, but he...
Yeah, there were a couple quiet moments for Kucherov through the season, but not enough to like really substantiate a huge drop from Braden Point in the second half. And some of that is just, you know, Braden Point's own bad luck and misfortune. Still, like, you know, he had a 67-point pace on the second half of the season, which really is not, like, that's fine. Right. I don't think we would have noticed it. I think, well,
it's okay. It's not,
well, yeah, because you want 90, you want 85, 90, 90. Let's just say 90 from Braden Point. But it just stands in starker contrast because the first half of Braden Point season was so, so crazy good. And one of the reasons it was so crazy good is because Point shot 30% through the first part of the season, which is one way that he really set the bar quite high and very hard to follow up on. So beginning the season on a shooting percentage heater didn't help Braden Point's second half look any better than it was. He did add a half a shot per game in the second half to his numbers, but that wasn't enough to compensate for Braden Point's regressing shooting percentage. He also was less involved on the power play and point production, and he lost power play points as a result. He was down 10 power play points in the second half versus the first, and his IPP was like way down in all situations at 50%. That's way too low. It should have been where it was in the first half at 75%. So I've seen enough here to say Braden Point is redder than he should be, because he had like just a too wild a first half, and the second half, what I see happen to him isn't overly concerning. It seems pretty reasonable. So for all those reasons, I'm just going to expect another great season, like Braden Point season averaged out to basically what it's been the two seasons prior, around 90 points, and that's where I'll go with him again next season. One incredible thing about Braden Point before we move on, he has shot above 20% for three consecutive seasons now. A huge part of that is, do you know that he has 51 power play goals in his last three seasons?
Wow.
Yeah. When you start talking again, I'm actually going to look up and see if that's the highest total in that time frame in the NHL.
Any player.
Yeah. But it's pretty impressive stuff. He, 20%, over 20%, three consecutive seasons.
What a career.
Seasons. Yeah.
He was picked in the third round, 79th overall in the 2014 draft. Brian, we've got in our upcoming Dynasty League draft, we've got 10th overall. The draft's starting on Sunday. I'm very excited. We've been waiting forever for this. We've got 10th overall, and then we've got like 31, 34, and 35. And I've been telling you for a while, like, I like having those three, you know, IRL late first round picks, early second, because I feel like just, is there lottery picks? But I feel like if you have three of them, one of them's going to hit, right? How can we blow all three of those picks? And man, could you imagine if we can get a Braden Point? Gotta find a 5'11 high scorer that fell in the draft just because, you know, whatever teams are worried about, but like a good shooter. That's our homework for that. I think there's actually a name coming to my head that I don't want to say, because now I feel like I'm tipping my hand. I'm not going to be able to get this person, but man.
What? Is that homework that, yeah, I like how you said that's our homework. I just don't know how much you can learn before the player steps onto the ice in the NHL.
Oh, I'll just say, I'm thinking of like Cullen Potter, who Calgary drafted. I think he's also like small and like got a ton of points, but he still fell in the draft. Though he was like late second or early second, late first. I don't have it in front of me. So Braden Point fell all the way to the third round. He must feel good. What do you think feels better, to be like, you know, I don't know, Quinton Byfield picked second overall? Yeah. He's doing okay, but he's working on it. He's a lot younger, of course. Or like Braden, I feel like it would be so cool to like have been drafted late and then be a star. I just feel like you could feel so smug about it. Like, all these teams passed on me, those idiots. And it's not like he was like nothing. I'm looking at the numbers for Braden Point here. In his draft year, 91 points in 72 games for Moose Jaw. So he was doing his thing. And all the teams, I guess, were just like, eh. Not the Tampa Bay Lightning. That's how you win a couple cups. Anyway.
There were not a lot of forwards drafted before him in the third round of that draft. Like, I'm just looking. Justin Kirkland, Dominic Turgeon, Juho Lamico, Warren Fogel, Connor Chatham, good. Alex Schoenborn.
Mm-hmm.
That's there are a couple goalies. Sorokin and Merzlikins went in two of the three picks before Tampa selected Point. Interesting draft. And that draft, by the way, features the true leader in power play goals over the last three seasons. Actually, the first and second. They went second and third in their draft year. Do you know who they are?
Oh, Dreisaitl.
Yeah.
Reinhardt. Yeah.
Yeah.
We last saw them in the Stanley Cup Finals. Also, this draft famous for having all the Florida Panthers. Ekblad, Reinhardt, Bennett.
Yeah, three of the first four picks and Dreisaitl in the middle. The rest of the draft was, a draft.
Nylander is there.
Yeah.
Should we just pause Red Boys and do like a redraft of 2020 or 2014 right now? Okay, let's go. We'll go back and forth. We'll do a top 10 picks. You get first overall. Go.
Julius Honka.
Okay, I'll say Nick Ritchie.
He's Josh Hosang.
Okay, so I guess you don't want to do this exercise.
Okay, I can. Well, I just thought you were buying it. Robbie Fabry, 21st overall.
Well, that's okay.
You know,
that's a swing.
I would have figured him. Kasperi Kapanen was taking the next pick. I would have figured Kapanen to be younger than Fabry.
Okay.
Even though he's played more games in the NHL.
Boston really nailed that 25th overall pick, David Pastrnak.
Yeah,
that's pretty good.
Yes.
Maybe if we can get a Pastrnak with one of our...
Pastrnak.
That would be
Thatcher,
really
handy. Thatcher Demko was drafted 36th overall in the second round. If we could get a Thatcher Demko, that would be...
There's definitely some goalies that are going to be available to us. Like, it's just a matter of, like, yeah, probably one of the top five goalies drafted will be a star, and the other ones might not ever play in the NHL. So it's so hard to predict. All right, let's go back to Red Boys. Actually, let's take a break. So we're going to take a break, then we'll come back, and then we'll finish off this selection of the reddest of boys. We'll be back in just a sec. So, Brian, yeah, we've done a pretty good job here going down. Like, there's other names on this list. Obviously, we don't need to bring up, like, how Jake DeBrusk did well at the start. You know, I'm trying to bring up names of guys that, like, I'd be interested in drafting for next year. I know you'd probably want to do a whole long Fabian Zetterlund segment, but I think we'll pass on him. I guess another defenseman who I think we talked about a bit during the season. I know you love him, but Jacob Chychrun obviously was incredible for you when you drafted him for your Cupful team to start. 27 points in 34 games. Way to go, Jacob Chychrun. Was really, you know, with good shots and all that make him like really valuable in fantasy. But yeah, he did quiet down. And if I recall correctly, we did a lot of Green Boy Washington Capitals, did we not, last week? I feel like, am I wrong about that? Where's Dylan Strome here? Where's Dylan Strome? Or
Dylan Strome is a Red Boy.
Oh, maybe it was a bunch of Red Boy Capitals.
I don't think we did. I don't see any caps on our list of Green Boys.
Oh, you know what it is? I've been listening to last year's Green Boys episode. I think that year there was a lot of Green Boy Capitals. But okay, anyways, Chychrun, like I said, 65-point pace in the first half, down to 43-point pace in the second half. That's a pretty big drop for a defenseman to lose over like 20 points per game in terms of his pace. Do you see anything to indicate which is the real Jacob Chychrun? Like, in terms of time on ice, I feel like he went up in time on ice. In terms of power play, I don't know. Was that the difference or what was it? You probably know the answer. I'm just like guessing here when you have the answer right in front of you.
Yeah, I have a bit of the answer. The first is that he was shooting 15%. And so that dropped down to 9% in the second half. Even though, like, it's kind of actually similar to Braden Point in that Chychrun added another, you know, I feel like sometimes you're scoring, it's like, oh, this is going great, I'm going to shoot more. And Chychrun and Point both did that. They both added a half a shot per game to their totals. Chychrun shot took almost 3 shots per game in the second half of the season, which is nice, right? Because we like Chychrun the most when he's shooting. So it was nice to see him shoot more. Still didn't shoot as much as he did in his Arizona days on the whole, but he was at least working his way back up towards it. Yeah, so a drop in Chychrun's own shooting percentage and a drop in his on-ice shooting percentage. He was actually, it was still high. Like, Chychrun's on-ice shooting percentage was still 12% in all situations, which means it was 6 in the second half, which is down from 16% in the first half. So fewer of his own shots were going in, fewer of his teammate shots were going in, and that's how he ended up at his 52-point pace, which, to be honest, I think might still be a touch high. Like, if I'm looking for a Jacob Chychrun repeat next season, I think you might want to try and find light. Like, it's a lightning in a bottle kind of pick, and so you got to see where you can find it. I mean, I guess one of the X factors here is John Carlson in Washington just had like the same point pace as Chychrun, and it was just it wasn't so hot and then cold. It was just like sort of mediocre the whole way through. And I wonder if Chychrun can find a way to spend more time on the top power play. He had a 53% share of the minutes last season. I don't know if and when he gets more, but I wonder if it's a possibility.
Yeah, it could be something that if he gets it, he can really take off here on this last season of Ovechkin, potentially. Imagine if it's the last season of Ovechkin and Kopitar. That would be, that's a big loss to the league. Guess we'll see. Ovechkin might not be.
I wonder what years have been the biggest, like, retirement, like, accumulated impact.
That would be a fun project. Let us know, listeners. It's the summertime. We got to fill these episodes with something. Brian, how about Mark Stone next? Because I actually have my pick coming up in my mock draft that I'm currently doing. Let me go to here to draft.cupful.com, this new fun draft platform.
What's that?
It's this new exciting draft platform. Anyways, I'm coming up to round. Oh, I'm not logged in this. Oh, wait, let me go to my Chrome profile because I'm logged into a different Patreon account. We're using logging in via Patreon. So, okay, I found it. Don't worry, everybody. Never fear. This is a great podcast episode. Anyways, yeah, so I'm coming. We're in round 9 right now. So I'm going to be, and I've already made my round 9 pick. I got Valerie Nichushkin at a pretty good, I think, value on 114th overall for the second pick of round 9. So who knows if even Mark Stone will be available to me, but I have him near the top of my queue. And I feel like he's, you know, the one thing that the main reason you people are wary of Mark Stone is he always gets injured and who knows when he's going to miss time. But overall, he tends to be really awesome. And last year at the start, I feel like just like every season lately, like a lot of people waited and took Mark Stone late in drafts just because they knew that he was going to miss that time. But then 33 points in his first 25 games, I'm sure had the person who drafted Mark Stone be like, I'm a freaking genius. And hopefully that person traded him, not because he was worried about an injury, though, or they were worried about an injury, which definitely could have been the case. But also, Stone slowed down a little bit. 34 points in his final 38 games, which is still good. That's probably more what to expect, right? I feel like that 100-plus point pace in the first half was never going to be sustainable. So is it reasonable to just expect while he's healthy, 70 to 75 points? Just hope that he can keep that up?
Yeah, it is. He's another guy. Like, you know, there's themes. Like, Elon, you made this great sheet, you know, compiling all the stats and showing the differences between first half and second half. And at the top of the sheet, like the green boys that we talked about last week, all these metrics that we're talking about, their shot, their shooting percentage, their IPP, their on-ice shooting percentage, their power play points, all in the green, you know, set. Like, and some of these are like counting numbers, but some of this is also variance. And then you look at the guys we're talking about today and they're all in the red, hence green and red boys. But Mark Stone is one of them too, where he shot over 20% in the first half of the season, came back down to earth with 10% in the second half of the season. He was great on the power play. He had 15 power play points in the second half, which actually helped to offset some of that shooting percentage regression. at the same time, his teammates, you know, weren't converting also at the same rate. Like, his own shooting percentage regressed, his teammates' shooting percentage regressed in the second half. And the overall point pace that we got from Mark Stone last season, which was right around 73 points, feels very right to me. The bigger red boy in Vegas was Ivan Barbashev. Did you, yeah.
He like was bumped off the top line at some point. Does that generally explain it?
Yeah. Let me bring up his, you know what? I checked his line combos and yeah, I didn't take
it. He was like super hot for sure at the start. I skipped him in the end because I just figured like no one's going to want to draft Ivan Barbashev after he was so nothing in the second half. But I guess that's the point of this episode.
Okay. Just to answer your question, then I'll let you. He played with Eichel and Stone almost the whole season.
I mean, that's pretty good. Will that last now that Marner's in the picture? I don't know.
Unlikely.
You would think, well, maybe he plays with Hurdle, but Barbashev could also go to the bottom six. And the thing with him also is there's just no power play to be had. So, like, now with Dorofeev even is maybe getting bumped. Though I actually saw, can I throw something out there? When we were talking about the Marner signing trade, I guess, I was saying this is probably good news for Shea Theodore because now he gets to be on a power play with Marner. I'm seeing some tweets from beat writers from Vegas. I guess everyone's just speculating, right? But there's being like, Marner, if you recall, like quarterbacked that top power play on Toronto. Like, theoretically, it's Shea Theodore that's getting bumped, and they can go five forwards. And they could have Dorofeev and Hurdle and Stone and Eichel and Marner. So just saying, like, Theodore might be a little risky. Like, hopefully, we'll just get more info before our actual drafts. But that would be a huge hit. Imagine if you draft Shea Theodore, expecting him to be a sure thing top power play guy, then for him to get bumped out. But, you know, Morgan Riley probably seemed like a sure thing top power play guy last year to everyone drafting him. And we saw what happened. I know, Brian, you're a big fan of Shea Theodore, and you're not such a big fan of Morgan Riley. But it could happen. Morgan Riley's telling you it could happen to you one day. Shea Theodore. So I don't know, just something to be concerned about. But sorry, you want to talk about Barbashev? You talk about Barbashev, and then after that, Brian, why don't you talk about like any other skaters on this list that you researched and you're interested in? And then while you do that, I'm going to bring up some goalie green and red boys, because I know people asked about that, and I forgot to do it, but I'll just bring it up really quickly.
Yeah, fantastic, because actually this is, I've got maybe one other player who you haven't brought up that
mystery.
I've prepped for. It's actually not even very exciting, but I'll keep you in suspense because we're talking about Ivan Barbashev first.
Coming soon, something not very exciting. You're listening to Keeping Carlson.
Stay tuned.
No, not an outbreak, just kidding.
Oh, okay. Ivan Barbashev scored 15 goals on 51 shots through his first 31 games. I'll say that again. 15 goals on 51 shots in his first 31 games. It's like Vince Dunn. A goal every other game. Seven of those goals came in his first eight games on 16 shots for Barbashev. And it was very exciting times for him because, yeah, he was playing with Stone and Eichel, getting some power play deployment and scoring all the time. In the second half of the sample, on the same number of shots, Barbashev only scored a third of the goals, five goals on 52 shots in 34 games. And the thing with Barbashev is that he's not a high volume shooter. So if he's not over converting, Barbashev does tend to convert on a lot of his shots on goal. But he's a low volume shooter and like he's not going to ever convert on 30 to 45% of his shots the way he was in the first couple weeks and the first half of the season. So Barbashev is one of these guys where I look at his second half and I see that it was an impressive, a 42-point pace. And I'm like, you know what? I could see that being Barbashev's full-season pace next season. A lot of it is going to depend on deployment. We don't know exactly the way, as you were saying, that Vegas's lines are going to shake out. And if Barbashev will be fortunate to play in the top six alongside some really fantastic players. But I would Barbashev is not someone that I would draft. I would draft, I guess he's in, Alex Laferriere territory, except I think I have a little more hope for Laferriere next season. Like, I would project Laferriere a little higher because I think he's a little more entrenched in the top six, and I think he is talented and just got a bit of a raw deal in the back end. The only other player that I will mention that I've prepared to talk about is Moritz Seider. And I guess I'll be the numbers guy since you're doing goalie stuff.
No, I can bring up Seider quickly.
Okay.
I don't want to lose my gig here, but yeah, he was a 50-point pace in the first half, only 35 in the second half. The first question that always comes to me with Sider in Detroit is how secure is that top power play? Because we did see him lose it to random guys like every couple of years, but last season he did hold it the whole year long, like as far as I recall. And I don't know if Simone Edvinson is like stealing that job next year. Like, I wouldn't think so. So I would think that, but even with top power play, he still, yeah, fell to like only a 35-point pace guy. So Brian, WTH, why the, I thought I could come up with a synonym for decrease that starts with H. You're good with words.
Why the hang up the phone on Moritz Seider's production? Why the halt?
Yeah, why the halt? That's what, you're clever.
There it is.
You should also
Well, I may be clever, but I'm not smart enough to really know what happens to Moritz Seider in the second half. He actually gained some power play production. He did lose some points participation. Like he was around, he was up above 40-45%, and he dropped down to 30%. And that's really the big thing that I can see for Moritz Seider that really like jumps out to me in the things we normally look at. I feel like it's not enough to explain why he went down to like a 35-point pace versus a 50-point pace at the start of the season, especially with that increased power play production. But I think Moritz Seider is someone who just seems to produce unpredictably and unevenly and is hard to really decipher like where he'll play in the lineup and when things are going right, what's going right, and when things are going wrong, what's going wrong. So I'll still like be interested in Moritz Seider at points in my draft. I'm going to say that he's closer to a 50-point player in the first half than the 35-point player he was in the second half, but I can't fully explain to you why.
Well, Shams has a theory here in the chat that Larkin and Raymond were hurt slash not as good after Four Nations, so maybe it's just the people around Seider were causing him to lose, you know, those points. So that definitely could be it, but I think I'm with you. I draft him as a solid. The good thing with Seider is he has those good peripherals. So you hope for around, you hope he'll do better than 35-point pace, right? Like if he could be like 45, 50-point guy with upside for 60, but then like good peripherals regardless, that's a pretty solid pick. I wonder, actually, last year I remember I felt smug taking Uyghur over Seider, and some people said I should have taken Seider, and Uyghur ended up being better last year. Now going into next year, Uyghur, I like him. Like, he was so good, but he becomes a little bit scarier now with, like, Zane Parekh in the picture. And, like, I just think of what happened in Montreal with Matheson. So it does, you know, make me a little wary of Uyghur. And maybe I would take Seider this year just for the more certainty of the top power play. Though this is, of course, Detroit. And, like, who knows? the coach that told us that Hanifin was going to QB the power play in Vegas last year. Like Shams is saying. So I don't know. Do you have a gut feeling before we switch to these goalies? And then I've got two goalies for you. Then we're all going to go home, okay? But yeah, Uyghur versus Seider, I don't know. I can't decide yet.
I'll go Uyghur. I don't see why not.
Does ASP Axel Sandin Pelika threaten the power play role? That's what Sabas is asking in the chat. Year one, I don't think so. Maybe one day. I wouldn't think next year. Is he even for sure going to make the team? I don't know. I don't think so. I haven't seen that. Let me know. Shams would know. Oh, Shams says he doesn't see ASP playing this year. Yeah, that wasn't the vibe that I got either, but maybe down the road. Okay, Brian, I got one red boy goalie and one green boy goalie for you, okay? I think this is pretty good, like, for a quick check here. What do you want first, the red boy or the green boy?
You know, why don't you give me both, and I'll... I see you DM'd me the names, and I know which is which. You know, why don't you introduce them however you want, because I really don't have any great metrics
I have no
to tell
idea.
You whether they're good. Like,
yeah, what about all your stuff you use? You're like expected goals against.
Yeah, I don't know if I can do it on the fly, but I'm going to...
Even strength, I'll, save percentage.
I'll see what I can do, okay?
I think you can do this. You've been doing this a long time. I have full faith. But yeah, I'll introduce both guys. Here is my green boy for you, and it is Filip Gustavsson of the Minnesota Wild. An incredible start to the year in his first... What are we doing here? Where's the game? I want fan tracks. Here's the games played column. I couldn't find that column. 27 games played for Gustavsson. He was killing it. He was 18-6, 926 save percentage, among the top save percentages in the league through those first 27 games. The only guys ahead of him who played like a significant number of games are Connor Hellebuck, Anthony Stolarz. Frederik Andersen only had 4 games. Okay, yeah. So he eventually had a decent number of games. But yeah, that's pretty much it. So like Gustafsson was right there. And I think a lot of people are expecting Gustafsson to be a nice guy to draft next year, especially with Wallstedt not having had the season in the minors that people expected. But yeah, Gustafsson did end on a bit of a lull. Like still, like I guess, average now that like 900 save percentage is considered average in the NHL. But yeah, he fell a bit in the next 31 games for Filip Gustafsson, only a 903 save percentage. So yeah, we're going from 926 to 903. The other name I'll throw at you in the other direction, our red boy, is Ilya Sorokin, who had a really tough go to start the season for the Islanders in his first 29 games. 898 save percentage for Sorokin. But then in the second half, which is actually surprising considering he played like every game in the second half, because if you recall, Varlamov got hurt and kind of never came back, and they just played Sorokin so much. And he thrived, 915 save percentage in 32 games for that back half of the season. So I guess in the end, really, Brian, you don't have to do too deep a dive. At the end, I just want your gut feeling of, is Sorokin or Gustafsson, are either of them like actually just what they showed in one of those halves? We've got, for each of them, we've got two halves, or you can do the total. I just kind of want to get a vibe of if there's any like sneaky value or maybe some buyer beware with either of these goalies.
All right. Gustafsson was like fully lights out at the start of the season at 5-on-5. He had a 942 save percentage, which is like incredible. For contrast, Sorokin had like a 919 save percentage, which is respectable. And still so far away from what Gustafsson had. And Gustafsson was playing 16 save points above his expected Fenwick save percentage. So that was huge for Gustafsson at 5-on-5. Second half of the season, Gustafsson at 5-on-5 basically played like an average goalie and was at a 916 save percentage. So down where Ilya Sorokin was and stayed for the second half. So Sorokin's 5-on-5 play actually went down. His workload difficulty went up, but his 5-on-5 save percentage went down, which shows just how hard he still worked. So Sorokin at 5-on-5 last season was actually pretty solid all the way through. Gustafsson had a fine second half of the season, but the first half was just out of this world. For Sorokin, the big thing that changed was shorthanded. He started the season in his first 29 games, he had a 775 save percentage on the penalty kill, which is bad. You want to be somewhere in the mid-800s. And the second half of the season, Sorokin had a 919 save percentage shorthanded, which, yes, is higher than his 5-on-5 save percentage was, which is quite rare to do. 913 at 5-on-5.
So you're saying both aren't reasonable?
For Sorokin?
Yeah, you're saying he was too bad and then he was too good?
Too bad and then too good. Yeah, and he was just fine at 5-on-5 the whole season through. Like not top tier, but still like good tier. Not like better than but not like elite. But I think that's good for Sorokin, to be honest. And it's reassuring that his second half was better than the first. Gustafsson was actually pretty stable on the penalty kill throughout the season. So most of what changed for Gustafsson was that he just was not a brick wall like in the second half at 5-on-5 like he was in the first half.
All right, so at the end of the day, Brian, what's your prediction? Who is the goal you'd rather have in fantasy next year, Gustafsson or Sorokin?
I mean, the Isles are so frustrating to talk about. They just feel too unpredictable. Like I don't understand their culture, their ways of being, their coaching. I don't know. And like a lot is shifting, right? Like Patrick Waugh is going to has publicly talked about making adjustments about himself for the next season. And Lou Lamoriello is out of the picture. It just feels like that's a hard situation to predict. But I have enough faith in Ilya Sorokin to think that he's going to put up some good 5-on-5 numbers. And if he does stink shorthanded, he's not going to stink for too long. Filip Gustafsson feels a little more up and down. But like even in the second half of the season, what looked not as great was still some really solid work from him in the crease. So I like both of them, to be honest. I'm not going to believe in either one, like having like the worst end of the season. I think I would go Sorokin and then Gustafsson, but is that a hot take? It doesn't feel like a hot take.
I think I'd go Sorokin as well. Seems kind of like a ceiling floor. I feel like Gustafsson has the higher ceiling because I think Minnesota, you know, if like Kaprizov stays healthy the whole time, like I feel like this team could win a lot of games. They could be like a really good team. And I think the Islanders, they might be like surprising, but I think they're going to be like at best like fighting for the playoffs would be like a nice result for them after trading away Noah Dobson is my guess. So I feel like you've got more win potential with Gustafsson, but I think Sorokin is like the guy who's got the leash forever. Like no matter how badly he does, he's still going to play a ton of games. And I feel like there is a scenario in Minnesota where if like Gustafsson has a couple bad games and if Wallstedt, who I know was disappointing last year, if he's there and he's doing well, maybe they give him a few more games. So I'll go Sorokin as well as like a safety. But I think that if you want to really swing for it, I think Gustafsson has the higher ceiling.
That's really interesting because I think I would have said Sorokin might have. Like, I think Sorokin's ceiling is at least as high as Gustafsson's.
I guess it depends how much you're counting wins. Like, a couple, we've got 3 points for a win. I just see Minnesota as like a team that could be, you know, right near the top of their division if things click.
Yeah,
I don't know
that's
if
fair.
I see that with the Islanders.
Yeah.
All right, it's goalies. Who knows? Well, anyways, hopefully everybody enjoyed this anthology. I guess only 2 episodes. How many do you need to call it an anthology? Since you're so good with words.
I think it's not how many. I think it's how long.
Oh, okay. Well, we've given you a solid 3.5 hours of Red Boys and Green Boys. So hopefully people have enjoyed these couple of episodes. Next up, Brian and I are going to record a patron cast on Thursday. So that's very uninteresting and boring for non-patrons, but hopefully exciting and cool for the patrons because we've got a lot of fun questions that have come in and we still have 3 more days for the patrons to throw us their questions. And Brian and I will tackle them all on our July patron cast, which is always a really fun show. Then Brian's going on vacation and we had this whole plan that we were going to put a bunch of shows in the hopper to release. We didn't do that, okay? We did these shows, and we released them 2 weeks in a row, which normally in the summer we take a longer break. So hopefully this is your hopper. But then I'm definitely going to at least record one show while Brian's away with someone to talk about prospects. And then also I've been talking, Brian, with Jeremy Versillo to talk about the NHL schedule, which has dropped. You know how Jeremy sometimes jumps in for the Matchup Maximizer episode. So he's already been looking at the NHL schedule and like which teams have good schedules, bad schedules, back-to-backs, like off date, all that fun stuff. So those are the couple shows that might happen while Brian's, which I'm sure Brian's, you must be super excited, right? Because you'll have these episodes drop and you'll be able to listen to them on vacation. You'll tell your family, hey guys, just leave me alone.
We're
for
gonna
an
pause
hour.
The No, I'm not going to say leave me alone. I'm going to say gather round. I'm
going to
put my phone in the middle of whatever table or surface there is. I'm going to push play. I'm going to say nobody move.
How long
will
do you
be
think
a test afterwards?
Who would have the harder time sitting still during an episode with me and Jeremy talking about the NHL schedule between your daughter and your wife? She would have the harder time.
I think, well, my daughter, I feel like could like get into like something in her imagination or something, like just like dissociate, and my wife would just find it irritating.
Okay, well, that's a fun challenge for Jeremy and I to overcome. Also, I'm like over-promising. Like, we haven't actually scheduled either of those things. But anyways, stay tuned. Stay subscribed to Keeping Carlson. We'll get those shows. And then by the time Brian's back, it's already going to be time to start the season. We're going to have like Schmorgoli's board and charcuterie. And if you have no idea what I'm talking about, it means you're not a long-time listener of Keeping Carlson. We're going to have a lot of good preseason stuff to get you ready to go. But yeah, thanks everyone for listening. Enjoy your next few weeks of your summer. Hopefully you're going on a fun vacation, or if not, hopefully you can dissociate like Brian's daughter. But Brian, why don't we cue the outro music and you can go ahead, read us the credits, and then you can go off on your adventures.
All right. After the patron cast, of course.
Oh, right. Of course.
Part of
That's
which,
part of it.
I mean, we're going to do, we may or may not, if we get to like the cupful feedback, the exit survey, we might release that part. We haven't really talked about it though.
Okay, we have some ideas.
I'm up for doing that. Anyway.
Really, all I care about is our Dynasty League draft that's starting on Sunday. This Patreon cast could stink. If we could get a really good pick with our 10th overall, I'll give up a
It's a good
cast.
Thing we're recording the Patreon cast before the draft, just in case it goes poorly. and then just in case the draft goes poorly, then you won't hear like the sadness in Elon's voice. He'll have some time to recover. Okay, hey. Did you know that this episode of the Keeping Carlson Fantasy Hockey Podcast was presented by Dauber Hockey and powered by our patrons, including our super supporters, Rick, Paul, Roman, Brian, Patrick, Aaron, Philip, Kaiten, Sammy, Andrea, Zach, Ryan, Steven, Thomas, Connie, David, Ricard, Patty, and Sean, don't think I forgot about you. Our newest super supporter, Sean. Thank you so much for all of that. KevinCarlson.com/patron if you want to get in on that. Thank you to our couple coordinators, Kevin Hebert and John Bruno. Elon is developing this draft tool. We'll talk about it more on the patron cast. It's $1 a month, by the way. Like, if you want this patron cast and all the ones that came before it, it's really easy to get. Go to that website I just said. Elon and Shims are doing great work over GameDayTweets.com. Today there was a piece of news. The Game Day Tweets notification channel on my Discord lit up with news about someone on the Penguins.
Anthony Mantha.
Anthony Mantha expects to be ready for camp. Is that it?
That was the big news of the day.
That was the big news of the day. Anyway, you'll get all kinds of fine nuggets like that. Logo art by BrandonWeave.com. Outro music by Pat Roach. This episode was researched with help from Dauber Hockey, Frozen Tools, Dauber Prospects, Natural Statric, Evolving Hockey, Puckpedia, The Athletic, HockeyGoalies.org, Hockey Reference, Hockey Viz, Hockey Database,
oh my gosh,
and Elite Prospects.
That's Psy. reading the credits sucks.
I was trying to de-automate the process, but I can hear how it came off.
We don't need to do credits. No one ever told us that's like part of our job.
It's
we
could just right
write, it in,
to, if
write it in the show notes.
If people were using our stuff, I would like them to mention it.
All right. Pat Roach, the way he made that music for us is really cool. I like that guy. A lot of people don't know who Pat Roach is. He's a friend of mine, and he's really talented. But he's not even selling his services, so it's not even like a commercial, because you can't get him to write the music. Well, I'm sure if you give him enough money.
It's good practice to cite your sources and to thank those who ought to be thanked.
All right, thanks, everyone. Brian, any final words? Words to live by?
Words to live by. Do what you can to make sure that fantasy hockey is for everyone.